And say hello. For those of you who don't know me, I am Lisa Smith, the Chief Program Officer here at the network. And we are so happy to see all of you workforce development professionals and workforce development CEOs joining us on this call. It's a special call. And we have Amy Mazur, the co-chair of the Workforce Development Affinity group, to thank for bringing Oprah. She's got a special relationship with him. And I don't know what's happening. She's going to introduce him, and she's also going to introduce our new co-chair, which many of you know because she's been on all of our groups, our affinity group calls, and we're so happy that you have stepped up to take on this role, Lisa August, way from JFS of Buffalo. So without further ado, Amy, take it over.
Okay. Welcome, everyone, to our August Workforce Development Professionals Affinity Group call. Happy to have you all on. We do have some exciting news before I introduce our main presenter for today. And the news is that Lisa August has stepped up as co-chair to help us plan programs and make this a good experience for everybody who's interested in workforce development issues for practitioners. So let me just welcome Lisa and just tell you a little bit about her. Lisa is the Senior Career Services Program Manager at JFS of Buffalo and Erie County. The focus of her work is counseling and assessment, but also placement. Among her subspecialties are assisting career changers, people with disabilities, and those who are navigating workplace distress. Philosophically, she uses a strengths-based approach and is dedicated to affirming the worth and dignity of her clients. Lisa has worked in career development for approximately 25 years. Prior to working at JFS, she managed a college career service at the SUNY system at Buffalo State and the University of Buffalo at Buffalo. Before she was a counselor, she worked in advertising and event management. In addition to her position at JFS, Lisa is an adjunct professor at Canisius College. So welcome, Lisa. We're happy to have you. Wonderful background and experience to help us move forward with our work.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, and I've really enjoyed working with everybody and happy to work with Amy and Lisa Lorraine to move us forward.
Great. Welcome. So what I'd like to do today is welcome everyone to the call. We have some regulars, and we also have some other folks from the Workforce Professionals Executives Group. We're happy to have you. And typically, we take the time to kind of introduce everybody. But given time, I'm going to actually cut that short. And just please make sure that on your name that you've renamed yourself and that you've put your location where you find yourself. And I think given Ofer's style and what I know about him, there'll be lots of time for interaction. So we'll probably be able to speak and engage. And when that happens, you can say where you're from and a little bit about what the experience is for you. We have the wonderful opportunity to hear Dr. Sharon speak to us again today. He has graced our presence in the past. He was here for in November 2019 when he did a presentation on the challenge of long-term unemployed among college educated professionals. He's also spoken many times through NJHSA and IAJVS through conferences that we've had. And he shared a lot of his information with us, and we've used it. We've used it here in Boston. I know that other organizations have used it to work with clients. So let me briefly introduce Ofer, and then I'm going to turn it over to him. Ofer's research and teaching focuses on careers, understanding how professionals make career decisions, search for jobs, use social media tools, and negotiate with employers. He also teaches courses and seminars on negotiations and sustainability. His specialties are research, teaching, training, careers, job searching, recruiting, negotiations, work, employment, labor market analysis, cross-national and cross-cultural qualitative research, social networking, sustainability, and social media. So if I left anything out, I don't know what it is, because he's definitely covered the gamut in terms of work issues and what we deal with our clients. Ofer's research focuses on career transitions, work, and unemployment. His studies are primarily cross-national comparisons, and he utilizes in-depth interviews and participant observations. Just making a note that his book, Flawed System, Flawed Self, Job Searching and Unemployment Experiences, is one that we've heard about, that we've used, and it has really helped our profession, which is nice, the cross between workforce development and sociology. We're happy to have him speak to us about or contribute that to our field. Ofer holds a BA in economics from the University of Illinois, a JD from Harvard Law School, and a PhD in sociology from the University of California, Berkeley. And I also want to say that his research areas are sociology of work, economic sociology, American society, social theory, and qualitative methodology. Did I leave anything out, Ofer? Okay, so I'm going to introduce his program, basically, and then he'll take it away. The opportunity will be to hear him speak, also to have him share with us what he's going to share today. And then at the end, we'll have a chance for follow-up, a little bit of wrap-up for us in terms of some details about oncoming programs. And this is being recorded, so just so folks know if you want to share it with others who are not able to attend. So let me start out by introducing what he's going to talk about today, which is a little bit different than what he's talked about in the past. And this was really exciting. I heard about this and thought that we would benefit. So let me go right into it. American poet Mary Oliver famously asks, "What is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" While Oliver's questions assume people have clear life plans, sociology shows that a variety of powerful forces, social forces, shape our aspirations and dreams, often confusingly pulling us in multiple directions. Moving toward clarity requires stepping back and reflecting about the social forces pushing us and pulling us. So today, Ofer Sharon will share information about the university-level course he has designed and taught at UMass Amherst to help individuals explore the effects of some of the most typical social forces shaping aspirations, including gender, family, and culture, and interactive exercises to help participants move toward greater clarity about their life and plans. So happy to have you, Ofer, and take it away.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, Amy, Lisa, for inviting me to come back. It's nice to see familiar faces. Hi, Cindy. I haven't seen you since you were in Boston, and
I know.
We worked very closely together. So it's great
to see you.
So like Amy said, today I'm going to talk about something different. Historically, most of my research is focused on unemployment. 3 years ago, I taught a class to undergrads at UMass Amherst, where I'm a professor of sociology, called The Sociology of Getting a Job. And the first month of that course really focused on what I call the sociology of aspirations, like trying to help students think about where their aspirations come from and kind of gain a little bit of critical distance on it to reflect. And it turned out that part of the course was by far the most popular. And I decided to turn that into a whole course. So this past fall, I taught for the first time the sociology of aspirations and got very positive feedback from students. That it was very helpful. It brings a multidisciplinary lens on the question of aspirations and including a sociological one. It's typically a field dominated by more psychological orientation and counseling. So I will share with you some of what I taught, and I'm very eager to get your feedback. So I'm gonna share screen, put up PowerPoint. Let's see. Okay. Can you guys see my slide? Look good.
Ofer, I'm just going to suggest to people.
Slides.
What?
I was saying, Ofer, we see both slides.
Both slides. Okay, I'm going to swap displays.
And also, we're going to suggest folks may want to use the speaker view so that you can see Ofer speaking and his slides. And then when he wants to open it up for questions, then go back to gallery view.
Are you seeing only one slide now?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Okay, so instead of talking to you about what I do with students, I mostly want to actually present some of the materials in abbreviated forms that I've used with students to encourage reflexivity. So reflexivity is a sociological concept referring to kind of reflecting on how internalized social forces and institutions can shape us, can encourage us, discourage us, shame us in terms of pursuing a particular kind of life direction. All right, so the goal idea is to just to have a little taste of this. And after I present, I'll be really curious if this is something you or your affiliate organization does with clients in some way. What might you do differently or change or add to the kind of thing I'm presenting? And also what age groups you think it might be helpful to. So I'm getting good feedback that students really get a lot out of this, but might this already also be useful for people in their 20s and their mid-career and older workers? I'm curious what you think. All right, so Amy already took some of my punchline here because I was in the blurb, but all right, so Mary Oliver famously asks, like, tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? We're probably all familiar with that. You know, Nike more kind of succinctly says to us, just do it. Really inspiring, but do we have clear plans when we ask people about what their plans are? Do people know what is this one true do it if they're gonna just do it? When I talk with students and when I read some of the research, it seems that most people have a whole cacophony of voices inside that are confusing, that are saying, do this, no, don't do that, actually do this. And it's hard to gain clarity with all those voices happening. So it's really rarely as simple as just looking inward or meditating and having an epiphany because of these conflicting voices. And the conflicting voices, and this is kind of the sociological piece, are in part because we live in a society that's giving us very different messages, and we internalize them. We internalize multiple different social forces and institutions about what's possible, what's desirable, what's cool, what's really embarrassing. So social forces can encourage us and push us in particular directions to like enact a particular aspect of ourselves, or it could discourage, suppress, shame, stigmatize, make us want to hide other aspects of ourselves. And reflexivity is the process where we gain clarity on that, on these different forces and how they're playing out and kind of the inner dialogue. Part of what motivated me to even teach this in the first place is that I think it's what I needed most as a young adult. So at age 26, I, you know, by all external markers, was very successful. I had a high paying job. I was, you know, making my parents very proud. And my friends thought my job was cool, but I was miserable. And I had been confused and I had made a mistake early in my career. I'll come back to it later. But I think I could have really benefited from this when I was younger. And so that gave me some of the motivation. All right, so the goal is to really create an inner dialogue that is more conscious, that is discerning about where different voices are coming from. that gives space for quieter voices, gives permission to shamed voices. And then when all these voices can be considered and heard and analyzed, then to have a more conscious deliberation and maybe answer Mary Oliver's question, or at least have a temporary answer for that plan. I'm going to focus on two forces today, gender and family. In the course, obviously, I go through others as well. All right, so let's start with gender. You know, when some of my students give me this look, like, really, gender in 2020? Like, aren't we beyond that? Okay, so this, I show them this to dispel any notions that gender is not playing a key role. Just look at the college majors pattern here. Computer science, 70% male, physics, 82% male, you know, then nursing, 80% female, social work, 85% female. So clearly, like, something's going on with gender and major choice, and I could show you career choice, and it would not be that different. So what's going on there with the social force of gender? There's really at least two major pathways that gender is shaping career directions and life plans. One is perceptions of skills and what's really my chance to succeed. And the other is what am I encouraged to do? What do I, which of my desires do I feel more encouraged to cultivate? So we'll start with the skills. So, you know, the idea is pretty straightforward, that to aspire towards a career typically requires a self-concept as being competent in the basic tasks necessary. Few people will pursue a life plan where they think they don't have the skills or the capacity to acquire the skills that would be necessary. So here's some research among male and female college students that have equal objective math skills. So objective is measured by high school test scores in math and their grades in math. Males are 4 times more likely to choose a quant major, like engineering or physics, STEM, and of course that affects then what possible careers are open to them. So this is among people with equal objective skills. Is it because males are simply more interested in quant subjects? No, that doesn't seem to be the driving reason, because if you look at males and females who self-perceive as equally competent, so before I was talking about objectively measured equally competent, but now I'm saying there's a 4-to-1 gap. But among those who self-perceive as equally competent in math, they're equally likely to pursue a quant major. So it seems that perceived skills are really a key driver. So this is research coming from Shelley Correll. She's a sociologist at Stanford. She did a huge study analyzing 35,000 high school students. She had access to their test scores, their grades, and also their self-evaluation. She surveyed their subjective sense of how competent am I in these fields. So she found that students with the same math test scores and grades had different self-evaluations by gender. So let's use the chat function. How do you guess this would work? For students with the same math test scores and grades, how might their self-evaluation vary by gender? You guys know how to chat on Zoom? Let's see.
I'm sure everyone knows how to do chat on Zoom.
Let's see.
I'm not sure anyone wants to answer the question.
Maybe. All right. You guys can speak out if you'd rather do that than chat. So what are you expecting in terms of students with the same math test scores and grades, how are these self-evaluations going to vary by gender? It's an easy question. Yes, males rated themselves higher than females. So thank you, Lisa. All right.
There's another one, lack of confidence that they know the right answer.
Yes. So this I think we know. But what about this one? Males are more likely to self-evaluate themselves as competent in math than females, and they have higher self-confidence in math. But do males self-assess themselves as more competent at everything? Is this like a male characteristic that's not math specific, or is this math? Any guesses about that?
I think potentially men feel they're more competent at everything.
So at least with respect to English, which is what we have the data about, they don't. And so, you know, I agree. This is an interesting, I think maybe surprising finding that, but it fits the pattern. It's just the inverse, right? So when it comes to English, females self-assess themselves as more competent than males that had the same scores and objective grades. So it's really the reverse happening here with respect to English than math, with females feeling more confident. So, you know, why do self-evaluations of skills systematically vary for those with the same objective skills? I mean, I think that we all know, I think we know the answer. It could be news to some of my undergrads, but not when they think about it really, about broad cultural stereotypes that are still very much ingrained in the media. It comes from peers, it comes from teachers, consciously or unconsciously, parents, you know, even parents that are very much like self-aware of not trying to reproduce gender rigid stereotypes, all kinds of research showing that it still happens.
There's one more comment, just to make sure it's,
yeah,
see that in some management roles as well.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. So I think that there's a whole line of types of jobs where these cultural stereotypes, I think, would lead men to self-assess as more competent. And you know, management, leadership roles, I think, fits into broad cultural stereotypes of what, you know, manly jobs are. You know, English, but I would also add, like, any kind of caring profession would carry the other implication for females and fits those stereotypes. All right, I asked students this riddle that maybe you guys know. I think it's kind of old, but a father and son are driving. You know this one? On a rainy night. I'll say it quickly.
I won't share.
And this one, it's better if you answer with the chat. Father and son are driving on a rainy, cold night. There's a terrible accident. Car rolls over. The father is killed instantly. The son survives, taken to a hospital, but needs emergency surgery. The surgeon runs in with the nurses. The surgeon takes one look and says, "I can't operate. This is my son." All right. How is that possible? Who's the surgeon? Yes, mother heard it. Okay. Yeah, so the surgeon's the mother. About half of my students are really confused by this question and say, "Oh, it's a stepfather." They don't really know. Maybe father meant priest. So these associations we have of gender and particular occupations are very deeply ingrained. The stereotypes not only affect how others see us, they also affect how we see ourselves, right? So this self-perception of skills is shaped with stereotypes that we apply to ourselves. And there's a thing called the confirmation bias, which is playing a very powerful role here. Confirmation bias is essentially that we tend to see evidence for whatever it is we already believe. And we tend to kind of disregard evidence that is contrary. So if we come in expecting to be not so good at math, we might pay attention to evidence telling us we're not so good at math. Or conversely, if we come in expecting to be good in English, we'll look for evidence that confirms that. There's also this other issue in terms of self-perception of skills, which is relative self-assessment when people are potentially strong in more than one thing, how that could throw you off. So for example, this is true for both males and females. If you're better at English than math, you will self-assess yourself as not so good at math. Even if your math is outstanding, it just might happen that your English is just like exceptionally, like you're a top 1% performer in English, might be only a top 5% performer, only in quotes. You may be very strong in math and able to pursue all, you know, career options there. But because you're so, you know, exceptional at English, you'll get feedback in your life that's superlative for English and only very good for math. And that leads to students to make relative comparisons of what their strength is and come to think, I'm not good at math. So this is one more way that people may have developed misleading self-perceptions of their skills. Siblings work in a very similar way. Like you might be very strong in math, but you might have a sibling who happens to be ridiculously exceptional. And so you'll feel like I'm bad at math just because you're not as good as your sibling, which is a very typical, easy comparison. Okay, so let's do a little reflexivity. Just ask yourself, to what extent do your self-assessments of your competence, of your skills, shape your career aspirations? And is there any potential that they might have been shaped by gendered expectations or stereotypes? And you can even go beyond gender in thinking about this and ask, is there some story you tell yourself about yourself that might deter you from pursuing one of your dreams, one of potential career paths, because you feel you're not good at it? Like, I love X, but I'm not good at it. Yeah, it's just like either free write or free think for 30 seconds, like what that might be. Some story you tell yourself about yourself that might deter you. Okay, whatever story you've thought about, now try to think of counter evidence. Try to see, can you immediately like think through and see if you can find a way to poke holes in that theory, evidence that contradicts the story. When I give my students, obviously I give them a lot more time to do this, but first they come up with a story, and then I give them even more time to think of, well, what in your life might contradict the story, typically they're able to say, to see the selective perception that goes into the story, right? The fact that they've focused on particular types of evidence in building up that story, and that there are other things in their life that they could have focused on more that would at least poke holes, if not point the other way. So I don't know if doing this very quickly with you generated even a hint of that kind of experience.
Or do you want to hear from people, or do you want?
I should look at the. It's very hard to follow the chat while also looking.
I can read it for you if you want. I can follow it for you.
Yeah.
So the responses are: it's hard to poke holes in something that is so well entrenched in your psyche. 200% it did.
Yes, it's easy to poke holes.
And yeah. I just want to draw your attention actually to before you started talking about this, there was a comment that you may go back, if you can go back to it. If it's at some point, how do the complexities of gender play into these perceptions? Do these assessments tend to align with the gender someone was raised, as in the case of gender non-conforming, non-binary, or trans individuals? Get back to that.
Yeah, I will just say we need a lot more research on that. I think gender nonconforming, non-binary, and trans is something researchers are really a little bit behind on. There's a ton more kind of traditional male-female comparisons and of traditional upbringings. So. There might be some very new cutting edge research on this, but I don't think there's much, at least as far as I've been able to tell.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
I know someone locally who's doing some of that work, and I can reach out to her and see if she has any new data. Sue Matulski is actually doing some work on that.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah. That's wonderful.
Okay, so then there's, this is likely the major and primary task that I need to accomplish with my clients, undoing their self-perceptions, the stereotype that is 99% of the time set in high school.
Yes. right. It's hard. And if it's set in high school, by the time I get them in college, I know it's already hard to shake. My college students say it's too late for me. They're a junior and they're already like majoring in communications and not in engineering. And, I try to tell them like, you know, if it's too late for you, I mean, what about people who I made a major career change at age 30, people do it at age 60. So it can feel like it's too late. And I think that's also part of the issue is talking to students about how making a change can, yes, it can be a detour. It can mean taking longer. On the other hand, they often will end up being stronger candidates to whatever they change into, because they also are able to bring in if someone switches from communications to engineering, they'll have all that communication skills, and they'll stand out as an engineer who can actually communicate. So you don't totally lose what it is you've done up to that point. You can integrate it usually in a way that is helpful. But it requires, thinking differently about timelines, and that can be challenging, I know for sure, for students. So far, I'm just like talking about gender and perceptions of skills. There's also just perceptions of desire, or like what you actually want, which is a different pathway that gender shapes us. But they're very strong cultured expectations about what we want, what we don't want. And we face a lot of ridiculing and potential shaming if we want to do the wrong thing, quote unquote, right? This is research of kids 2 years old about boy peers not reacting positively to other boys who are not playing in a masculine way. And then by age 3 and 4, there's already ridiculing among boys. This is actually, there's more rigidity for boys than for girls in this realm. I'll skip that. It's a good clip. So I will, I'll skip this with you guys, but this is the way, what I will ask students to do is to write about some significant longings they've been discouraged and shamed from pursuing because of not conforming to gendered expectations, and then try to go beyond gender. For some people, it's not, gender is not the most salient thing. It's some other aspect of themselves that has been discouraged or shamed or ridiculed just because it doesn't fit. It's not classically what a responsible, quote unquote, or mature adult in American society would do. That may be gendered or may be some other beyond gender issue. So then I have students discuss this peer-to-peer and then report out to the class. They often will report pretty powerful effects of social pressures to pursue particular directions. All right, let me quickly touch on family. So a whole different social force is how our parents shape our aspirations, including through the examples they set, their direct or indirect communications of their expectations to us, right? So parents teach by example, right? Just not even intending to be teaching anything. They pick a job because they enjoy it. My first example there, they pick a job that they don't particularly enjoy, but it pays well enough to support a family in a middle-class lifestyle. They don't mean to be teaching their kids anything, but they are. They're setting some kind of example. Or in the second case, they pick an enjoyable career, but one that requires staying at work late and not being around for family dinners. That's also, there's a lesson there, intentional or not, about what matters, what priorities should be paid attention to. It's inevitable, right? Whatever it is the parents choose is sending a signal to the kid. So I have students reflect about their parents, or it could be some other significant adult in their life. What have they learned? And they're consciously or not, just by observing their parents. Then there is communication that is most often indirect. I'm drawing on Mary Jacobson that Amy Mazur introduced me to, her book. But, so Mary Jacobson says, and it resonates with other research in sociology, that particularly in American culture with our individualist ethos, parents often don't tell the kid you should be a doctor. They tell the kid you should do whatever you want to do. Like, that's kind of the official story. But then there are things communicated in a less direct way that are nonetheless very powerful, including stories of who the kid is. You're a chip off the old block. You're just like your mother or father or some grandparent. Ever since you've been born, you've loved doing X. So these stories are not directive. They're not telling you should do this. Do you think they have effects? Just describing to the kid who they are, this mirror, like you've always loved X? I see a lot of nodding. Of course. And think about the role of confirmation bias here, right? So confirmation bias is you see evidence for what it is you already believe. So, it's very difficult for a parent not to develop a particular perception of a child as being a particular way or loving some particular thing, and then, you know, seeing evidence for that because they already expect it, and it's hard for the parent to get the distance to be surprised. So confirmation bias can make this effect stronger. You know, I've conversations with students about how parents are in this unique position that makes them, on the one hand, the people that know you the best, they know the details of your life the best, and so they are very valuable to talk to, but they also might be a little bit trapped in a particular understanding of who you are that is may not be up to date with who you are now, right? And so that's the value of getting perspectives from people who are not your parents, or maybe who don't even know you for many years, but can just more see you without that filter of a history. That's very valuable. All right, and this is a very interesting point, particularly resonated with my story that Jacobson also makes, which whatever your parents, quote, dreamed and never attained will profoundly influence your life. So this is the pattern that parents really wish to give their kids, whatever it is that eluded their grasp, something they really wanted, so obviously something they think is very valuable, but they weren't able to get, and so they really want their kids to get it. So I mentioned before my, you know, being 26 in this job that's externally successful, but made me miserable. So the backstory is that when I was in college, I really wanted to go to graduate school, and at the time to study philosophy and be a professor in that. My father thought very strongly I should be a lawyer, and that would allow me to provide for a family, and that I would have more security. And, you know, there was a very strong part of my father's kind of security concern. You know, we were immigrants to the US that I had internalized. And so I came to the conclusion, yes, it's too risky to get the PhD. I should go to law school. And I did. I went to a good law school, got a good job, was totally miserable. So at age 28, I left the law and started a PhD program. And now I'm doing exactly what I love. But about 10 years ago, my father was very sick with cancer. I was driving him every day to the hospital to get radiation. And we had a lot of conversations, mostly like political arguments. But in one of those conversations, he told me, out of the blue, the story that his dream had been to be a lawyer. And there was some issue in college where he couldn't major in law. In Israel, it's an undergrad major. And he had never told me that back when I was a college student, and he was pushing me to go to law school. And, you know, I looked at him, I'm like, okay, I didn't say it, but it just all clicked, like why he had pushed that hard. And he was completely unselfconscious of this, having a huge impact on my life, his dream that he never attained. So I tell students to interview their parents about what is it they've always wanted but never got, and then think about how that might have shaped or played out in their own lives. Right. So the reflexivity here for this unit would be about what might you be taking on because your parents communicated verbally or non-verbally that it's important or honorable. What might have you desired, dreamed of, that your parents thought directly or indirectly communicated to you or is unimportant or risky or shameful. Right. Then we do peer discussions. So Yeah, I will. Okay, before I go to the next slide, basically we go through gender, family. I then have other classes about their experiences with school and the messages they've gotten through the educational system, the messages that they've gotten from media and from consumer culture about what's important, the effects of social media, the effects of advertising, essentially of living in a market, capitalist market society. How, you know, so we will go through these different important experiences with different social institutions that powerfully impact them. And after we do that, then I bring in, I try to say, let's introduce one more voice. And this is also, will involve an exercise I learned from Amy. But this is a concept of flow that I'm sure you're all familiar with. But it's very exciting for my students to learn about, right? Engagement, things that engage us so intensely that time stands still, that we become engrossed in activities, kind of like play for grown-ups. I'm not going to try to pronounce the name of the author. At some point I could pronounce it, but I have let go of that. So, and here we do a peak experience exercise where I have students reflect on two or three peak flow experiences, and it may have nothing to do with career-related stuff or work stuff, but just three times in their lives where they felt most engaged, most like time stood still, most like they were connecting with a part of themselves that felt really immediate and authentic. And then they look for patterns in those experiences. And then they talk with each other about what they notice about each other's experiences. You know, and then this is the exercise. The course overall then is trying to make sense of these voices, but also add this voice of flow, add voices that may not get a lot of play, right? So the goal overall is to discern where the different voices are coming from, gender, culture, family, give space for the quieter ones, shamed ones, stigmatized ones, but then also include actual voices that come from experiences, direct experiences, what we can learn from those. And then the best we can do, I think ultimately, is to have a more conscious internal conversation and hopefully not just keep it internal, but find people to talk to, a variety of people, not just parents and not just peers. I think career counselors are ideal people to talk to through this kind of issues. And so that's kind of gives you a taste of what this looks like. So thank you. And I am very curious specifically about how you think this might be relevant or not relevant for non-student adults, what you might add to this or change. I also just put it out there that I'm interested in I have an interest in presenting this to as a workshop by Zoom. I've done it for high school students now. If you have a group of clients you think would benefit, I'd be happy to talk about doing that or to even collaborate to create an even better workshop. All right, so that's it. Let me end the slideshow or the end the screen share.
Thank you so much, Ofer. Okay, so everyone, you may want to put it back on gallery view so we can see each other and we can respond. If you want to either speak in the chat box, I will be monitoring that, or if you want to raise your hand, if I can see you and I can try to call on you to see what you want to say to Ofer, who we have now, and we can give him feedback. I wanted to actually kick us off because Ofer didn't say this, but he was sharing this with me, and this is why I wanted to share it with you. This class was extremely well received by the students at UMass Amherst, so much so that I hope, Ofer, you'll just say briefly a little bit about some of the kind of feedback you got from the students. But in addition, Ofer won an award from the school for this being, for him teaching this kind of class. I'm not sharing it quite right, but it was so well received that the students gave him such high marks that he won like teacher of the semester, year, whatever it was, because of their reaction to this opportunity to go deep like this in ways that they sounded like they had not had a chance to do before. So I do want to respond to questions in the chat or answer any questions that people have or have give Ofer a chance to respond. But could you just speak for a moment about a couple of the comments that students made to you about this experience, if you do that?
Yeah. The feedback really was different from any other class I've ever taught. Specifically, so there's at one level, typically I'm teaching them sociology. Here, the sociology is being used as a way to better understand themselves and others in the most direct way possible. And so they, that was part of the comments. But the other comment that ran through, and I think the thing that actually was most powerful for students that said it was a life-changing experience to take this class was the level of dialogue they had with their peers as facilitated through this. So my lecturing and kind of telling them about research did something. It kind of set the stage. It planted some seeds, raised some questions. But then the real magic happened when I told them to, I gave them substantial time in class to talk to each other. Including some classes devoted to peer-to-peer interviews where they really went in depth on some of these issues, talking with their peers. And here they said that they just had never had felt kind of permission to ask these questions or to talk and share about these issues with people their own age before. And that was very powerful as a way to better get to know themselves because they hear themselves talking, but also to just notice how others may share the same anxieties. I mean, one of the biggest anxiety a lot of them have is I don't really know what I want to do. I don't have a passion. I'm really, and they think they're the only ones and that everyone else has it figured out, right? So this is a really nice revelation for them that nobody's got it figured out. Everyone's really confused. There's a lot of commonalities about what things are really confusing them, the issue of money, the issue of security versus things that are more interesting is a big theme. So the way to talk, to talk honestly with peers about that was very powerful.
I think everyone on this call understands that concept, because you have to make choices, right? This isn't a field where the money is made necessarily, but people enjoy the work they're doing. I think it's a lot of what you said. You think about when you're younger, but if you're trying to change your career, you have to think about it now too. And how brave, you have to have a lot of courage to change your career. This is a tough time to change a career, I imagine. So many people are out of work. But I'll stop talking because this is your affinity group.
So Linda wrote to us, what do you know about the students who have the most change as a result of this awakening? For example, does it happen more often to gifted kids? That's a question in the chat.
I really hope to be able to answer that in a couple of years because I'm now starting to follow the students that I taught. I'm surveying them and interviewing them to see, what really sticks, not just in the immediate, yes, they said it was very powerful. There were a couple of students that made life changes during the semester, like one guy decided he's actually going to go to art school instead of pursue a degree, a career in communications. And it was, felt very risky for him, but the class led him to think that that's the right move for him. You know, for most of the students, they weren't sure what they wanted to do coming in. They weren't sure what they wanted to do going out. But they said it had a big effect. I think it. I need some time to see how this plays out for them. I know what they were thinking career-wise when they came in, like what the different set of options they considered as possible. That's a very early assignment I give them. And then I have all kinds of writings from them throughout the semester, which they've given me permission to use in research, about how things started to evolve. But I really need to take a year or two distance from this class experience to see how, what choices they're really making, and look for patterns, because I think that will be really interesting.
Well, I think part of it also is that they've never been asked or asked themselves their questions before. So even if it's the catalyst to get them to think differently about work and what career means and options, that's an important part of their growth because, you know, societally we say, okay, high school, college, boom, you know, you're on, boom, that's it. And the reality is so much more complicated than that. And nobody tells them this, nobody ever shows them this. So we get the 26-year-old in the office saying, I did what I was supposed to do. Now what? Yeah. So I think just opening their eyes is may not be quantifiable initially, you know?
Mm-hmm. So that leads me to just following up with, do you think this is, I mean, for 26-year-old, like for people in their 20s, like is this, you know, my college students were saying I might be too late for me. Like, how relevant do you think this stuff is to different age groups?
In my opinion, it's relevant for everybody. I put in the chat box as you were talking that this is the biggest task I have to accomplish with my clients. And especially because I work with so many people with disabilities, they have a lot of messages, you know, and I get 60-year-olds that I have to undo the I'm not good at math perception, or right. I'm not smart, or school's not for me, or people like me don't do those things. Or, you know, sometimes it's the converse, you know, I'm a physician, but what I really want to do is flip houses. Mm-hmm. And unbundling that is, yeah. So I,
yep.
And it's almost applicable in exactly the same way, in my opinion.
Ofer, I want to also thank you, Lisa. I want to just draw your attention to some of the other comments in the chat box. Zipporah said, I think I can think of two particular young career counseling clients that stated, I don't know what I want to do, where all the assessments showed a clear preference. The problem was that the preference contradicted their parents' wishes. And then Sandra asked, I believe you put out a paper, Ofer, not long ago after COVID kicked in, and it pulled no punches about the difficulties we face. But that was, I think, probably your Atlantic article, maybe is what you, how would you look at this type of class and the findings based on where we are today vis-a-vis COVID?
Good question.
Thanks for the easy question. Let me first say about Zipporah's point about career wishes contradicting parents. That is a huge issue. When I did this workshop for high school students, it was high school students in Lexington, Massachusetts, which is a upper middle class suburb where parents have really high expectations of their kids, and about half the kids wanted to do something like study liberal arts or history and had parents saying, no, you must do something like business. And that is a very confusing moment. And I think I was finding myself wishing I had good, like, I wanted to have advice for the kids for how to talk to their parents. Or maybe I should talk to their parents. I don't know. But maybe parents need this kind of course. But it's a difficult issue with parents, especially, and some parents will use their, you know, I will not pay for college unless you do something practical. The parents are wielding their power.
Gopher, I have a great idea. Maybe we could do a parent webinar with all the agencies, and you could present this, and all the agencies could bring their parents together, you know, on a certain day and time. It could be something fantastic. Just throwing it out there.
COVID.
I just want to say we would have, you know, going across the screen at the bottom, counselors available at the end of this seminar so that right. all the parents can get the help they need.
In the communities, right, in all the communities.
No, like immediately, Lisa, because they'll be going, oh my God, I've ruined their lives.
Well, yes. And no, we can get them at all different ages, right? Not just that they ruin their lives, but they can potentially prevent that. Anyway, there was another comment you were going to, the COVID comment.
Mm-hmm. Right. I find that very hard to speak to because for the young students that I taught last fall, had no idea, of course, this is coming. They're finding it very hard to stay motivated, to look for jobs. It's already hard for a young college grad to get a job, a good job. And their feeling is there are just no jobs out there. It's a terrible time to look for work for my students that I've talked to. And the hope is that this will turn around. I mean, the thing about college students is, as opposed to older workers are at higher risk for getting stuck in long-term unemployment. So the stigma when you're 50 or 55 and have been out of work for a while, you may never get back on track to the kind of career you had. That kind of employment gap is often just not forgiven by employers. Where I think that's not the case for the young college grads. I think here employers are more willing, able to look at the potential of the young person and be more forgiving of employment gaps early in careers. So that's, something encouraging for that group, but I know it doesn't feel very encouraging for them right now. And it's an incredibly difficult time. And it might get harder. We all know, I think, the important role that the CARES Act played in supporting people up to this point, and now we're in this limbo without necessarily the supplemental unemployment insurance. And so it's a very scary time we're in.
Any other questions or comments? We can thank you very much, Gopher, for sharing this. It was interesting and valuable and insightful in terms of the way people make these decisions at all points in life, and your example of with students is hopefully something that could be instituted, maybe starting with the UMass system, maybe. But
can I just ask one question?
Yes,
I know this is not done as a, you know, my course is very unusual for a college class, but is this the kind of thing? Are you doing this kind of thing? Is this, you know, talking about influence of gender, family, culture? Is this a part of career counseling that happens in your organizations? Yeah, I see a lot.
One on one,
yes,
or one on one, but not group.
Yeah.
Go on, Cindy. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Cindy. Go ahead.
I think the group thing, Gopher, is phenomenal. And I think it would take the bite. This is just my opinion. I was thinking about it. I was like, it's another one of you and Amy's brains, wonderful kind of coming together or thinking is, you know, the power of that collective thinking that we all benefited from in Boston so much is my first thought was, oh my gosh, that collective thinking that you saw with your college students takes the edge, I call it the edge, off of so many of those things that we hold on to as individuals, that we get into that shame, that whole nobody else thinks like me. All of our work with the long-term unemployed and that, we saw that when we brought them together as a group and that conversation that they were able to have, how quickly those sharp edges fell off. And I could see it being very impactful at a variety of ages. So you've done it with your college students and you did it with high school students. So you've had two groups so far.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I can see it. I could see it as a workshop. You would maybe want to market it a teeny bit different to different age groups just to draw the right numbers in that you would need. But oh my heavens, yes, because it's so much more impactful to have that conversation in that group, or at least I believe it is, than it is that one-on-one dialogue. Because then, even as a career counselor, career coach, when you're giving them that homework to go out and do it, if the first person that they talk to is somebody who's had influence on them, they're going to hear the same message again. And they don't get that peer-to-peer. I mean, I'm guessing that's why your students were like, oh my gosh, there's somebody else that thinks, has the same struggle I do. I'm not alone. And that changes your whole dynamic. I mean, we see that pop in people's in our offices and in our conversations, in our coaching sessions, but just the groups, even when we brought groups together, that dynamic, how the edges fall off of that. I use that model as much as I possibly can from what we learned in that original, you know, it's even if you can create informal, I've started calling them, you know, conversation pods. If you can just occasionally get people together to have those kind of pose the question and let them have the conversation, guide it or facilitate it if you need to. Sometimes you don't even need to do much. But I could certainly see this. Yeah, the parents of college or high school students trying to make that college decision are going to at the end go, oh, what have I done to influence this? But they'll also be going, oh, maybe this is why I'm so unhappy. And can I have help too? You know,
thank you, Cindy. Thank you so much for these comments. It makes so much sense to me. And it's a connection I want to think about more that, you know, we work together with Amy in Boston, supporting long-term unemployed job seekers, older, and we did create a lot of peer groups and fostered conversations around a different set of issues. It was about the difficulties of getting a job and why am I unemployed and lessening the edge of the self-blame. But I do think something very similar happens with the college students around issues of not knowing what I want to do, et cetera, and feeling pressure from my parents that kind of makes it a much easier issue to deal with because others are going through the same thing. So, thank you.
I can see this workshop or a version of this being really meaningful for a parents' weekend sort of event in the college setting. Because obviously parents have such an influence on what their kids are doing. And I think that way you're approaching it both ways. You're working with the students and you're also educating the parents. So I think that could be a really, really valuable target, you know, demographic to approach. In the Boston area, a couple of career centers are using the designing your life approach, which, you know, is a little bit of a different approach, but also looking at how to build a meaningful life. And they're doing that in either like a 2 or 3 workshop sort of offering. And one of the colleges has a semester long course, designing your life course, capped at about 20 students, in which there's a lot of peer interaction. So really great to have a long-term course to discuss these issues, I think, because they're really deep topics.
The advantage of COVID-19 that it threw us into a virtual world, and the advantage of this is now that we don't have state-city boundaries anymore. So we can create a program that can offer the same message to nationwide and have people from all over the United States participate. So we don't have to have a big audience to create it if we can already may benefit from that.
Agreed. That was my point.
Yeah, even beyond the states too. I know we have some.
Is there time for one more question?
Sure.
One more, go ahead.
Oh, one more, sorry, Andy. I didn't realize what time it was.
Yeah.
Well, it's a two-parter. One is, do you think there's something about the confines of a classroom that allows these students to have permission to have these conversations? Because you might say these same conversations could take place in the cafeteria, or could take place in the evenings when they're getting together. So what is it about the classroom that gives them the permission to have these important conversations, part one? And part two is there a big difference between one-on-one, two students talking to one another, versus an actual group where there are more people with whom they can interact?
Wow, these are great questions. I think...
You'll have to come back, Ofer.
I'm pretty confident from what the students told me that these conversations don't happen in the dorm room or in cafeterias. And I think the reason is that these are very vulnerable things to share. And it feels risky, and students don't want to appear as confused or as lost, you know, as they might feel with their peers. And I think the classroom creates an environment where it's normalized, right? So having these kinds of feelings is introduced as like a lot of people have it. So it makes it a safer space. We also have people promise anonymity and
confidentiality
with each other. One-on-one versus groups, also a great question. I think that the best I found is going back and forth, right? So some things only get initially shared one-on-one because they feel risky and difficult to share. But the most powerful is when those things leave the one-on-one and go into a larger group, because then in the larger group, you're likely to have others that really resonate. With the one-on-one, it's like the chances that will really be a similar experience for the other person are not as great as when it's shared with the whole group. So often I do it sequentially. I start with one-on-one paired difficult conversations, and then I invite anyone willing to share with the larger group what they talked about one-on-one, and some brave person will go first, and then that will give kind of the permission structure for others to share, and they've already talked about it and gotten, you know, nothing bad happened to them. So that's kind of how I build into a larger group conversation of things that are tough to talk about.
Great, that makes sense, thank you.
So we're actually at time, and we could probably do lots and lots more on this, but I wanna be conscious of that. And also, thank Ofer for a great presentation, an in-depth presentation, a great way to think about this work. And I want to invite folks, you're going to have the recording, we'll have that available to you, you can listen over and over, and we can always invite Ofer back. I want to let you know that our next call will be on September 16th, where in some ways Ofer will be back in spirit, because we're going to introduce a new program that he's part of a team on. Myself and David Bluestein and Ofer are part of a team of researchers. It's an international collaboration of practitioners and researchers. We have a new program to introduce, and we're going to hot off the press. NJHSA is going to get to hear about it, and we want the feedback about what we're thinking about in this time of COVID. Be sure to be on that call on the 16th. We have on October 21st, Lisa August, our co-chair, is going to be speaking about navigating assessments in the remote world. And then November 18th and December 16th, we'll remind you of the dates. We have more programming coming along. We invite you to be in touch with us about topics of interest or getting involved. Speak to myself or Lisa, either Lisa. And again, we'll give you our emails and hope that you'll stay in touch. We really enjoy this opportunity to share and be with each other. You can see, you know, Ofer is impressed with all our questions and what we're thinking about. This is a group that really is on top of it. We're excited to stay connected. And I hope that we see you all. Welcome back or come back and stay in touch. And thank you all for your participation and engagement. And have a good month.
Okay, everyone stay safe. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you, Ofer.